Former President and Nobel Peace Laureate Jimmy Carter joins us this hour. If you have questions for him about his presidency and politics, about the election and the future of the Democratic Party, about his career since leaving office, or about his many books, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. President Carter's new book is called Sharing Good Times. The author joins us from our bureau in New York, and thanks very much for joining us on Talk of the Nation.
Neil, it's good to be with you and all your listeners.
As you note, most of the 19 books you've written are about pretty serious stuff in what most people would regard as pretty serious times. Why did you decide to write a book about, well, there are chapters on fishing and baseball, about vacations and bird watching, about sharing experiences with your family and friends?
Well, I wanted to give a more balanced point of view of what a human being's life ought to be like. I have been driven with ambition on certain parts of my life to be a successful businessman, to be a successful naval officer and submariner, to be a successful politician and so forth. But mixed in all of that has been a growing belief or realization that we should reach out throughout our life every year to have good times, to have fun, to enjoy life, to have more interesting experiences. And also, I try to point out in the book how difficult this has been for me at certain points of my years, and also how every experience of enjoyment can be enhanced if you bring in with you partners who are people that you love in your family or close friends. So sharing good times, I think, rounds out the meaning of the title. Have good times. Share them whenever possible.
A lot of what you write about, it seems to me, there's a thread through the book of learning to be a successful husband as well. there's a moment, for example, when you write about your decision to leave the Navy. My unilateral decision to return home, I didn't accept any argument, became a divisive factor in our marriage. Rosalind was furious, having learned to relish her independence as a Navy wife. But I exerted my dominance as a husband. She hardly spoke to me during the 1,000-mile drive from Schenectady.
Well, as a matter of fact, she never spoke to me. when she wanted to relay a message, she would tell one of our children, the oldest one of whom was 6, tell your father that we should turn off at the next step because I have to go to the restroom or something like that. She refused to speak to me. And it was several years later, as a matter of fact, before we really learned as a husband and wife who loved each other, how to share basic experiences or basic decisions that affected our family's future. Even as late as 1962, when I was 38 years old, all of a sudden I decided to run for the state Senate. I got up one morning, began to put on my Sunday clothes. Rosalind said, "Jimmy, has one of our friends died? Are you going to a funeral?" I said, "No, I'm going to America's to qualify to run for the state Senate." I didn't even discuss it with her. That is almost inconceivable to me now. Since then, she and I have learned in a mutually beneficial way how to share almost everything of an important nature with each other, and it's added a lot of enjoyment to our life. And now we do almost everything together. We go bird watching, we climb mountains like Mount Kilimanjaro together, Mount Fuji together, up above the base camp. We learned how to ski together when I was 62 years old. We played tennis against each other. We swim together. And so all of these things, we are avid fly fishers together. Now we do all the enjoyable things with each other and bring in our 4 children, our 11 grandchildren, and their spouses and loved ones. So now about 23 of us get together because we have finally learned not only how to have good times, but how to share those good times with each other.
There's an interesting moment you write about. I think it's in one of your campaigns when you were running for governor of Georgia. And your wife walked past and you said, would you please pack my suit? I have to leave town tomorrow. And she just turned to you and said, do it yourself.
That was a turning point in our life and in our marriage. I was shocked and at first quite angry. And so I packed my suitcase and left on a week's campaign. And during that time, I realized that Rosalind had as many duties to perform when we were at home as I did. And that from then on, as a matter of fact, since that day, she has never packed any of my clothes, and I've never been tempted to ask her to do so. Although we help each other whenever we can, but we've learned to give each other space and to respect each other's ambitions and each other's duties. And I think that's one of the reasons that we've been able now to have, I think, the best part of our 58 years of marriage. The last few years have been much more intimate, much more pleasurable, as we've learned how to give each other plenty of space to develop independently, but to share as many things as possible with each other.
Yeah, there was one occasion, though, when you two tried to write a book together that didn't work out so well.
That was the worst time of our marriage. We had had a very definitive study at the Carter Center called Closing the Gap, where we analyzed all the reasons why people don't use what they know about taking care of their own health. And so we decided to write a book together about it. And part of that was just to outline, to make the book interesting, things that we had done with each other, like fall in love or have dates and things like that. And we started writing the book, and it was a catastrophe. We didn't get along with anything. We finally deteriorated our relationship to the point that we could only communicate with each other by writing ugly notes back and forth on our computers. We couldn't talk about the book to each other. I write very rapidly, and Rosen writes very slowly. When I would give her a chapter that I had written, she looked on it as just a strictly a rough draft. When she labored over a chapter and gave it to me, it was as though she had just received it from God on Mount Sinai. Every word was precious and sacred, and if I tried to make a change, it was like an insult to her. So we finally decided to give up the book and to return the advance to the publisher. Luckily, we had an editor named Peter Osnos, and Peter got us together and said, look, you can't agree on these paragraphs. That's been proven. There's no way that you can ever agree on who is going to have the dominant voice in this particular paragraph. So why don't you put a J by half of them, Jimmy, and put an R by the other half, Rosalind. And so we published a book, Everything to Gain, Making the Most of the Rest of Your Life. And if you buy the book and read it, you'll see that a lot of paragraphs have J's, a lot of people have R's. Those are the ones on which we can never agree.
It's interesting. Most of us obviously think of you as an ex-president. We know of all your work with the various, the Carter Center, of course, and charities like Habitat for Humanity, the diplomatic efforts you've taken. But you see yourself these days primarily as a writer?
Well, almost all our income is from my books. As you mentioned earlier, I think this is my 19th book. They've all been fairly successful. And I've really enjoyed the writing part. You know, I've written autobiography, I've written analyses of political affairs, I've written books on how to negotiate peace agreements, I've written two deeply religious books explaining my faith in God. I've written a book of poetry, I've written books for children that were illustrated by my daughter Amy, and so forth. So this, I've had a whole gamut of kinds of books written, and I decided to write this one just to give the other side of life, a humorous, very retrospective and revealing book about the torturous evolution of my life to turn away from just hard work and dedication and pursuing a career to enjoying God's world and sharing it with others. So the income from my books have been the overwhelming portion of our family's income.
I'm talking with former President Jimmy Carter about his politics, democracy, about, anything you want to talk about. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. His new book is called Sharing Good Times, and let's get some listeners on the line. Jeff joins us. Jeff is in Detroit, Michigan.
Hello.
Hi.
A pleasure to talk to you, Mr. Carter.
Thank you, Jeff.
I was wondering if you might contrast your Christianity and how you put it into action with Habitat for Humanity and teaching Sunday school and whatnot with our current president's very vocal Christianity.
Well, I wouldn't want to make any comment on President Bush's depth of belief or his own Christianity. And I'm hesitant to answer your question to contrast mine with his. I feel that I worship, as a Christian, the Prince of Peace. And I worship a Savior, Jesus Christ, who devoted his life, his words, and his actions to the alleviation of suffering of those who were outcast or poverty-stricken or who was suffering from disease and so forth. I worship a Savior who emphasized justice, humility, telling the truth. And those are the moral values that I feel exemplify Christianity. And when I say that, I'm not insinuating any derogation of other people who profess to be Christians.
Jeff, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Here's an email message as we move on to politics from Corey Bruley in Minneapolis. What do you think it says about the Democratic Party that the only successful candidates for president in the past 30 years have been from southern states?
Well, I think that's a tribute to the South. First of all, as a matter of fact, I was the first candidate who was successful from the South in 140 years.
Well, Lyndon Johnson.
Well, he was a Southwesterner, and he made darn sure that the voters in our country didn't look upon him as a Southerner. He never campaigned one day in Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, or Louisiana. He referred to himself as a Southwesterner. And so I don't look upon him, you know, as having been a Southern campaigner. But I think James K. Polk, before that, was the first one from what I would call the Deep South. And from the southeastern states.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of prejudice then, I think part of it justifiable, against our region because we epitomized the racial discrimination that had been an embarrassment to many people all the way through the Civil War and then 100 years thereafter. And it was only after we came out of that abyss of prejudice that we were looked upon as reasonably acceptable. And I was the one who happened to exemplify that change.
Mm-hmm. Let's get another caller on the line. Jennifer is with us from Akron, Ohio.
Hi, President Carter. I'm a huge fan. I was just wondering, as far as your perspective on this most recent election, what was the failing of the Democratic Party? Did we choose the wrong candidate? Did we speak to the wrong issues? What did we do wrong?
Well, I'm not sure that we did anything wrong, Jennifer. I think the basic failure of the Democrats was to align ourselves as much as we deserve to be aligned with the phrase moral values. And I think we let the Republicans steal the image of pursuing the highest aspects of humanity and human ambitions and goals and standards. That was a mistake, that we let the Republicans steal that issue. And unfortunately, for many people, this was narrowly defined as encompassing the abortion issue. I personally am opposed to abortions except when a mother's life is in danger. And homophobia, that is anti-gays. And I would say the exaltation of trickle-down economics, which is enrich the rich even more, and maybe they will share some of their benefits with poor people. And this seemed to be saleable. The other thing that was very valuable to the Republicans was the equation of President Bush as our savior, as commander-in-chief, against the constantly raised threat of terrorism and a war. And it's very difficult for, at any time, for Americans not to exalt the commander-in-chief, no matter which party he might represent. And I think equating him with our military personnel overseas, even though we were fighting a completely unnecessary and avoidable war, was a very important facet as well. So there were some issues there over which I don't think any Democratic candidate could have prevailed completely, but we could have done better on the moral values issue.
Jennifer, thank you for the call. We'll take more of your calls and emails for former President Jimmy Carter. We're talking about his new book, Sharing Good Times. We're going to take a short break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Our guest today, former President Jimmy Carter. We're talking about his life, politics, the role of faith in the presidency, the future of the Democratic Party, and the future of the country. If you have questions for President Carter, you're invited to join us. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Here's an email question we have from Don in Berkeley, California. Mr. President, he asks, what was your experience like in Cuba, and how did you get along with Fidel Castro?
The experience was unforgettable. I refused to go to Cuba for a long time until Castro would agree in advance to let me make a speech directed to the Cuban people without any interference or censorship. And after a long period of negotiation, this was finally agreed. And he fulfilled that promise. In my speech, in Spanish, in which he was in the audience, I severely criticized his human rights abuses and his deprivation of his own people of their rights, even under the Cuban Constitution. That was a potentially disruptive factor between me and Castro. After my speech was over, he came up to me with a very solemn face. I didn't know if he was going to want to argue or what. It was in a university in Havana. And he said, "Don't forget that the Cuban All-Star game, baseball game, is tonight. And you've promised to go. Would you still go, even though you disapprove of my policies?" And I said, "Sure, I'll go to the ball game." So we went to the baseball game. And this is the biggest thing in Cuba. They don't care anything about basketball or football or soccer. All they think about is baseball. And this was the biggest sporting event of their entire year that happened to be the same night. So he and I went. And when we got to the stadium, the baseball stadium, he said, I have one request to make of you in your entire trip. I won't ask you for anything else." And I said, "What is it, Mr. President?" He said, "I would like for you and me to walk out on the baseball stadium grounds to the pitcher's mound without any security. I would like to show the world that you're not afraid of the Cuban people." And I said, "Fine." So we did. I threw out the first baseball, and later Fidel and I signed that baseball, and at one of the Carter Center fundraising auctions, I gave the baseball to the Carter Center, and it was auctioned off for an enormous price. There were people bidding on that baseball all over the nation, and it finally brought $165,000. So as far as the Carter Center is concerned, we benefited because we sold the baseball, but it was a very good trip. We were able to travel throughout Cuba any way we wanted to go without any impediment. We met with the human rights heroes in Cuba and listened to their reports on what they needed and learned a lot about Cuba's infrastructure. We didn't go to the tourist hotels at all, just among the people. So I would say it was a very productive learning experience for me.
I have to ask, who had more stuff on the ball, the old softball pitcher or the old hardball pitcher?
Well, Fidel didn't throw a baseball that night. I was the one who threw it, and I think, as a matter of fact, I threw a strike, which is one I don't always do that. But I'm still a good softball pitcher, not a very good baseball pitcher.
Let me ask you, you write in the book, Sharing Good Times, about the trip you took in 1994 to North Korea
yes.
and visited another, dictator. This is, of course, Kim Il-sung. His son has since taken over. But this was an interesting moment, a critical moment in the history of the relations with North Korea.
Yes.
You wrote at that time, it was during the Clinton administration, that this was a mistake for the United States not to be engaged in direct conversations with Pyongyang. Obviously, there is the son who has taken over now. There are the six-party talks. Would you see a way ahead with North Korea?
Well, I believe in generic terms, Neil, that it's a mistake for our country to refuse to have talks with people who are causing serious problems. And that obviously applies to Fidel Castro. It applies to General Cedras in Haiti. In 1994, it applied to North Korea, and I think still does. There's an onus attached to meeting with an international pariah or outcast, as was Kim Il-sung. But the problem is that the Carter Center tries to address, these are the people that might be causing the international crises, that might be committing human rights abuses, who might be initiating or perpetuating an unnecessary war. And unless you're willing to talk to them or communicate with them in some way, it makes it almost impossible to resolve the crisis. So that's why I went to North Korea. At the time, I was convinced, and our military commanders in South Korea were convinced, that North Korea was on the verge of launching a military attack against South Korea. And I went in a vacuum because no one else would go and resolved all those problems, at least at that time. And President Clinton tried to follow up. Since President Bush has been in office, though, he has absolutely forbidden any American official at any level from talking directly to the North Koreans, and he insists on doing this through a six-nation committee. I can't say that he's completely wrong, but if I had my way, we would have had direct talks with the North Koreans long ago in order to resolve what is still evolving as one of the most serious nuclear crises that affects the international community.
And just to get back to Cuba for a moment, I got so tied up in asking the baseball question, I forgot to ask, is it time to lift the embargo?
I think so. We should lift the embargo and at least open up the trade opportunities between us and Cuba that relate to food and drugs, that is, medicines. That would be the first thing. What we're doing is punishing the Cuban people directly. We're not punishing Castro. And at the same time, we're making Castro look like he's a hero, fighting a David, fighting a Goliath in Washington, which I think is also unjustified. It also permits Castro to blame all his self-induced economic problems on the United States embargo. So I think we should lift the restrictions on travel to Cuba and also lift the embargo, at least on food and drugs. That would be a major step forward, in my opinion, toward returning democracy to Cuba and not perpetuating Castro's oppression of his own people.
Let's get some more listeners involved. This is Michael, who's with us from Richfield, Ohio.
Hi, how you doing today, President Carter?
Doing fine, Michael.
Good. It's great to talk to you. I'm a big fan. And I just want to thank you for the implementation of some of your environmental policies in the 70s, which many of us know were quite revolutionary and led to even other policies with the health and welfare of our people here in this country. I think the environment is one moral value many people in our country overlook. So my question to you is, do you believe this administration that we have currently in office could possibly overturn some of these policies?
In my lifetime, this is the worst administration we've ever seen on environment. They have tried in every way possible to undo the environmental legislation that has been passed in former years by President Nixon and President Reagan, as well as by President Johnson and Clinton and me and others. So no matter where the origin of protective legislation has originated, under Democrats or Republicans, this administration has tried to undo it. If there was a conflict between environmental quality on the one hand and in enhancement of profits to corporate entities who want to destroy the environment, they've always ruled against the environment. And I hope that this will change because of pressures from the general public and because of people who devote their lives almost to the protection of the environment. So a bad overall, almost unanimous commitment against the environment in Washington. We need everybody who is interested in the environment, as you are, to speak out. And I agree with you completely that this is one of the moral values that should have been emphasized in the last election and I hope will be emphasized in the future.
Mm-hmm. Just to follow up on Michael's point, you were president at a time when there was a great energy crisis in the country. Oil prices were spiking. There was embargoes. Oil prices are very high now. How do you pursue energy policies that make fuel available to people at reasonable prices and continue to protect the environment?
Well, if we would just reinsert into American law the bills that were passed when I was president, that would make a major step forward. When I became president, for instance, in 1977, the average mileage of an automobile in America then was only 12 miles per gallon. And I passed laws eventually over horrible opposition from the automobile manufacturers and a few others to increase that step by step to 28.5 miles per gallon. When President Reagan went in office, he alleviated those restraints on the automobile manufacturers and others. So now we have a back down to a very low mileage on automobiles because extremely large vehicles are excluded from the restraints. And this means a lot to our oil and energy consumption. For instance, if you could increase just 1 mile per gallon on all the automobiles in the United States, which could be done very easily with law, it would much more than balance any sort of income from new oil that could be discovered in the Alaska wildlife region. That's the kind of thing that needs to be addressed by this government. And also, there are many other ways to save fuel. for instance, the elevation of standards on home insulation, on the manufacture of electrical equipment, like refrigerators and stoves and so forth, to make them more energy efficient, air conditioning units. Those are the kind of things that can be done and are not being done now.
Let's get another caller in. Stanley is with us from Mayfield, Kentucky.
First of all, President Carter, I'd like to express my admiration for what you have done for America during your presidency and especially since then. My question is, during the hostage crisis, why didn't you threaten the Iranians with a severe deterioration of a valued asset and do it progressively until they released the hostages?
Well, they took our hostages, or Stanley, in November, the same on election day, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm. 25
years ago. And within a month, when I saw that they were not going to release the hostages, I got all the other leaders in the Western world, in Germany and England and France and so forth, and we sent the Ayatollah Khomeini a message from me. And I told him, through the Germans primarily, so he would be sure to get the message, that if you injure a hostage, we will interrupt all Iran's commerce and trade with the outside world, with a total sealing of all your seaports and all your airports. And if you kill a hostage, we will retaliate with military weaponry to destroy part of your country. That was a threat that remained extant all the time I was in the White House. And never was a hostage injured, and never was one killed. And every hostage came back free and safe to the United States. At one time, one of the hostages who happened to have been from Maine developed a partial paralysis in his right arm. And because of the threat that the Ayatollah had, that hostage was peremptorily released and came back home so that that hostage would not be considered injured or dead in captivity. So we did do exactly what you suggested. The alternative that I had to that patient addressing of this crisis, which was very terribly damaging to me politically, but even more so obviously to the hostages, was to treat it peacefully. I could have destroyed Iran militarily, which I think might have been politically popular. It would have resulted, I think, almost immediately in the death of all our hostages. But I decided to be patient with it. And I had two goals in mind. One was that all hostages come back safe and free, and the other one to protect the integrity of my country. I prayed a lot about this, and at the end, my prayers were answered.
Stanley, thank you. We're talking with former President Jimmy Carter, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. President Carter, at the time of the, I think it was the Russian invasion, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, you issued what's become known as the Carter Doctrine, saying that the United States would fight if necessary to keep the free flow of oil from the Persian Gulf. Is this, at any time, have you had any cause to reconsider this?
No, that wasn't exactly what I announced or threatened. The Russians, the Soviets at that time, were already in Afghanistan. They were trying to take over that country. And I was very concerned that if they were successful, they would move on further south into Pakistan, into Iran, seeking warm water ports in the Indian Ocean and also seeking control over all the oil reserves in much of the Persian Gulf area. So I announced that if the Soviets made any further moves outside of Afghanistan, that the United States of America would consider this a direct threat to our own national security, and that I would respond accordingly, not foregoing the use of ultimate weaponry, which was a code word for atomic weapons. And this is what I threatened, and I was prepared to carry it out. At the same time, we gave secret help to the Afghanistan freedom fighters, primarily using weapons that bore the Soviet trademark, and we got them from Egypt, from other allies or former allies of the Soviet Union, and from Saudi Arabia. And I think it was that action on my part that prevented the Soviets being successful and ultimately having to withdraw from Afghanistan. And obviously, they did not threaten adjacent countries. That was the so-called Carter Doctrine.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, the greatest diplomatic triumph of your presidency was the Middle East Peace Agreement. It's quite a number of years on now, and peace seems as elusive as ever in the Middle East, at least peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Do you see the four power talks, the roadmap to peace in the Middle East? Do you see this as a promising? Where do you see things going ahead? And obviously, there's great change now after the death of Yasser Arafat.
Well, there can be great change. You know, this administration is the first one since Israel became a nation that hasn't made a sincere effort to negotiate any kind of peace agreement between Israel and Israel's neighbors. Every president, Democratic or Republican, has made this effort until this time. And there has been a total cessation of any kind of peace talks, as you know. The Palestinians will have another election on the 9th of January. That's presently scheduled. When they had a previous election in 1996 in January, the Carter Center was the only monitor of that process, and we may become involved next month. I may go myself. I haven't decided that yet. But if the Palestinians can have a truly democratic election and choose a leader that would be acceptable to Sharon and Bush, then it may be that good faith talks can commence again. This will depend on the leaders in Israel and Washington, and also on the new leader in the Palestinian community to prove that the Palestinians can live in peace during a negotiating phase with the Israelis. When I was in office, I was successful. I think it's the only permanent agreement that has been worked out in forming a treaty of peace between Israel and Egypt. At that time, Egypt was the only formidable challenge to Israel's security. And that treaty that I negotiated in the spring of 1979, not a word of it has ever been breached or changed or broken. And so this has been a good symbol of what can be done in the future with further good faith negotiations.
Mr. President, could you stay with us for a couple more minutes?
Okay.
More of your calls and emails for former President Jimmy Carter after a short break, and we'll also get an update on the peace negotiations underway in Belfast. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our guest this hour, we're privileged to be joined by former President of the United States and Nobel Peace Laureate Jimmy Carter. He's at our bureau in New York. He's got time for a couple more questions. Here's an email we have from Robert Yeager. He asks, Mr. President, I was very impressed with the quality of your work shown in a recent issue of Fine Woodworking magazine. As a professional woodworker, I'd love to hear his thoughts on our shared craft.
Well, I've been building furniture since I was a young future farm of America. And when I was in the Naval Service in submarines, I got some advanced instruction from some of the superb hobby workshops that the Navy owned in Hawaii and so forth. Since I left the White House, I've really concentrated my efforts on learning more advanced woodworking techniques. And I've now built about 150 pieces of furniture since leaving the White House. Some of them, I think, quite good. And I'm still learning, by the way. But I've really enjoyed this, and within the last year, I've carved out in the corner of my wood shop an artist studio. So now I've also taken up oil and acrylic painting, and I'm learning how to be a painter. So I'm either building furniture or painting a picture now in the spare time between writing books and doing my other duties. And this is just part of what I've tried to describe, you know, in the book I've just written, Sharing Good Times. Some of our good times can be cherished alone, like when you're designing and building a new piece of furniture. The other times that you have fun, and everybody ought to look for those opportunities, can be shared with others. But alone or with others, I think one of the things that we overlook too much in this modern-day, fast-paced, frantic world is just enjoying life. And that's what I've tried to describe in this new book.
Let's get one more caller on, and this is Joseph, who's with us from San Francisco.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
President Carter, I just want to say what a pleasure it is to speak with you. I have both a comment and a question. my comment is, at the time of your election, I was much too young to vote, but I saw the excitement of my parents when it was their turn to vote for you, and I believe that's what instilled a passion for politics, or at least taking an interest in politics on my part. My question is, of your post-White House years, the humanitarian efforts that you have and your interest in Habitat for Humanity, of all those humanitarian causes, what made you decide on working with Habitat for Humanity?
Well, the international headquarters for Habitat happens to be just 9 miles from my home. And a lot of the leaders of Habitat, including the founders of Habitat, come to my Sunday school class in Maranatha Baptist Church in Plains. So that's really why I got involved. But we really enjoyed that. And every year, Rosen and I go together to build at least one house with a small crew, and then we build other houses with volunteers who join us. And one time in the Philippines, we built 393 houses, small houses, in 5 days. In South Africa, a couple of years ago, we built 100 houses in 5 days. This year, in October, in southern Mexico, in two cities, we built 150 homes with other volunteers. So this has been a very important part of my life. But the overwhelming portion of my year, the other 51 weeks, as a matter of fact, we spent at the Carter Center alleviating suffering around the world, mostly in Africa. We just got back Sunday from Mozambique, where we monitored Mozambique's election. Mozambique's one of the poorest and most destitute and troubled countries on earth. Earlier, we did the election in Indonesia, the fourth largest nation in the world. But on the way home from Indonesia, we stopped by the Kamchatka Peninsula on the east coast of Russia and spent 6 days going down a wild river fishing for trout. So we've tried to combine, you know, our hard work, both at Habitat and at the Carter Center, with finding times in between, or sometimes often on the same trip, like bird watching, to really expand our enjoyment of life. So it's been a good opportunity for us in the post-White House years.
Joseph, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
And Mr. President, I just briefly, I have to get back to politics. I'm sorry.
Okay.
But you said before the break that you're thinking about whether to go to monitor the elections, the Palestinian
yes.
elections. Obviously, the presence of a former president of the United States would not go unnoticed, would have an effect. What factors are you trying to balance here before you make your decision?
Well, we've been invited to go by the Palestinian leaders, and we've been approved to go by the Israeli government. Making proper arrangements in this brief period of time, just a month left, and getting adequate financing for the trip would be two things. I've already carved out a gap in my own schedule so that if these uncertainties can be resolved, then our intention is to go. I think it's very important. I believe that the future of the Israeli peace effort with the Palestinians will depend to a great degree on the success of this election. And although there's some extreme difficulties in prospect, I think it's worth that much of an effort on my part as representing the Carter Center.
Mr. President, thank you very much for being with us, and good luck to you.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it, Neil, very much. Bye-bye.
Former President Jimmy Carter joining us from our bureau in New York. His new book is called Sharing Good Times.